I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cases from the Community. Today, we're going to talk about colorectal cancer. We have an outstanding faculty today, Dr. Kristen Siambar from the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and Dr. Eric Van Cutsem from the University Hospital Leuven in Leuven, Belgium. And to make this interesting, we're actually going to present cases from general medical oncologists in community-based practice. We'll show you the case, and then you'll hear the questions by video that these docs have that they would like to see discussed. General medical oncology is a pretty great challenge nowadays. It seems like almost every cancer, there's some new and exciting things going on. It's a real challenge to keep up to date. Here's where we're heading. We basically have two kinds of modules. We're going to do like a meeting within a meeting here. So the first thing we're going to do is present these cases. But we're going to alternate that with some discussion or rapid fire discussion. We're going to try to cover about 15 papers presented at the GI ASCO meeting on colorectal cancer as we go through this. So before we start, just kind of maybe taking a step back, Eric, and I'm curious about your perception in terms of this meeting, Eric, from your point of view, what you think maybe the most important data sets that were presented at the ASCO GI meeting in colorectal cancer. I was telling Kristen before the meeting that I even though Eric has educated me about GI cancers over the years, I hope that maybe I've educated you a little bit about American rock and roll. And, you know, Kristen, when we have our meetings, we always like to play some 80s rock and roll. And Eric's always asking me what, you know, who the group is, et cetera. So, Eric, anyhow, I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts about ASCO GI this year in terms of colon cancer.
Thanks, Neil, for the introduction. So ASCO GI was interesting as always, and it's especially interesting for discussion and doing, let's say, maturing the data and discussing them and putting them in the perspective. But the most interesting practice-changing data were the updates of KEYNOTE-177 on pembrolizumab in the first-line treatment of MSI-high colorectal cancer.
And we're actually going to talk about that in a little bit. Kristen, any thoughts that you have about data sets that were presented there that you want to reflect on?
Yeah, I do agree. I think the KEYNOTE-177 was really important data that we're still trying to understand. I think what really came about from ASCO GI this year was that we're trying to understand the basis for some of these responses and trying to figure out what can move forward into larger phase studies and what really has promised to change practice in the near future.
Well, let's start getting into some cases. And this really, you know, colon cancer is a lot different than it was 5 years ago. It's really a biomarker-driven disease. And Eric, and I can remember so many different algorithms we played with over the years. It seems like every year it changes slightly. But we're going to try to tease out some of the nuances here. This is an interesting patient, 65-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Brenner in Boca Raton. And the patient had right-sided disease, a metastatic disease. You can see also the patient had a KRAS G13B mutation, which I'd be curious to know what you think about. But interestingly, he had a TMB of 11. And anyhow, here's Dr. Brenner with his questions about the case.
The patient started therapy with FOLFIRINOX with PEG for gastrium support in December. My question for the investigators are, should FOLFIRINOX be the standard of care for patients with right-sided colon cancer? Or should we use FOLFOX or FOLFIRI? Is there any recommendations about which agent may be better to use? Also, do the clinical investigators recommend that patients be tested for the UGT1A gene polymorphism before using irinotecan? Due to the fact that this patient has a tumor mutation burden greater than 10, would you consider using immunotherapy with pembrolizumab? And if you did, where would you sequence it in a treatment?
So let's start out, Kristen, with these first questions. What do you think about the issue of right-sided metastatic disease and FOLFIRINOX, et cetera? Agree or disagree, Kristen? And also any comments about the UGT1 heterogeneous gene polymorphism and what its relationship to using irinotecan in this situation?
So I think we have a lot more options these days in the first line setting. I have been using some more FOLFOXIRI, really FOLFIRINOX dosing, because I don't use the 3200 per meter squared 5FU. So it does wind up being more like FOLFIRINOX. But I do that more in the first line setting, particularly for patients who have a high tumor burden or who are younger, and I think that who can tolerate that kind of regimen. And that largely comes from especially the most recent TRIBE2 data, which shows an overall survival advantage in the patients that get that upfront, you know, aggressive induction. But there are certainly patients who, you know, either have a lower tumor burden or might not, I'm worried may not handle that very well toxicity-wise. So I think there definitely still is a role for FOLFOX bevacizumab or FOLFIRI bevacizumab in the right side of, in the first line. And in terms of UGT testing, I don't routinely do that. I don't think that it impacts my practice quite as much, and the testing takes time. So often I don't want to wait to start therapy. But, you know, certainly that's still open for discussion.
So, Eric, any comments on upfront treatment of right-sided disease and also this issue of the TMB, you know, and again, putting aside regulatory issues in the United States, we have an approval TMB over 10. This patient has a TME of 11 and microsatellite stable. In general, Eric, would you consider outside of a trial using a checkpoint inhibitor right now in MS stable disease? And what about this situation where you have a TMB that's high?
Usually we restrict checkpoint inhibitors to the MSI high and maybe the Pol E and Pol D mutations. They are rare in this setting. TMB is probably or possibly, let's say it like that, a valid biomarker, but it's not yet validated enough. And usually outside of a trial, we never use TMB as a predictive marker to take a decision on Pembro or Nivo in colorectal cancer. Regarding the other question, in first line, I use occasionally FOLFIRINOX, only a low number of patients receive FOLFIRINOX in my practice. That's the BRAF mutants, and that's the young patients, good condition, where we RAS mutant, and also where we really want to downsize the tumor. But in the vast majority, also the right side, that I will not give FOLFIRINOX to my patients. I usually give FOLFOX with BEF in the right-sided patients.
So just to finish out on this, Kristen, because I'm curious about your thoughts about TMB. I mean, you know, any patient with a solid tumor who's run out of options is going to be asking about a checkpoint inhibitor. So many, we have no evidence that it's going to benefit, yet patients still get it with hoping for some type of a home run. When I saw that indication for TMB, I was like, where's that going to fit in? So does it fit in colon cancer from your point of view, Kristen?
It was a bit surprising when we did get FDA approval in that indication, and I think it is controversial. You know, it more often is a continuous biomarker, and we don't see many patients who are non-MSI high and non-POLE who actually would qualify. I don't think that it has a lot of benefit in the, you know, 10 to 20 range, but, you know, certainly if we've run out of options, it is an indicated treatment. But I would counsel my patient accordingly as to expectations. But I have not given it for that indication yet.
So, Eric, this is like, you know, oncology improv, because you two don't know what's coming here, both the videos as well as what's going on in the chat. It's like making rounds. So, Eric, interesting question in the chat room. Timing of chemo radiation and radiation and neoadjuvant chemo and total neoadjuvant treatment for locally advanced rectal cancer. This person wants to know what comes first. How do you do total neoadjuvant therapy, Eric, for rectal cancer?
Difficult question, and our practice has changed completely today in this regard. What we usually do, if we have intentional watch and wait, then we usually give a long course of radiotherapy, so 45 grays in fractions of 1.8 to 2 grays in combination with 5-FU. And then in the interval, we give FOLFOX if we have intentional watch and wait and TNT. Occasionally today, but then that's not for the intentional watch and wait. That's just in the neoadjuvant setting. If we're planning to operate, so in the bigger tumors, we give a modified rapido regimen with 5x5 plus FOLFOX. So we have completely changed our clinical practice over the last 6 months, according to the recent strong data that have been presented.
Okay, Kristen, here's another one. Dr. Chen from California, near up in the Bay Area, a 62-year-old woman. Interestingly, passed through a history of Hodgkin's lymphoma 15 years ago, treated with chemo and involved field radiation therapy. She has a colon cancer picked up on colonoscopy and ends up getting surgery and adjuvant treatment. And then not that long after, maybe 6 months later, is found to have a metastatic disease. But interestingly, she's MSI high, tumor mutation burden very high at 88. You'll hear what happened to this patient and what Dr. Chen's questions are for you.
She underwent NGS testing, which showed that she's MSI high. TMB was 88 mutations. She was started pembrolizumab in July of 2020. She underwent CT scan for restaging after 4 cycles. At that time, actually was concerning for a slight progression. However, we decided to continue the pembrolizumab. And after 8 cycles, the CT scan demonstrated a partial response. However, at the same time, she developed shortness of breath, and the CT scan also confirmed that she has evidence of pneumonitis. Some of my questions include, how often do we see a delayed response from the immunotherapy? Currently, we're holding the pembrolizumab, and she was started on steroids due to the pneumonitis. Would it be safe to resume the pembrolizumab after course of steroids in her? And would you recommend adjusting dose or frequency of the pembrolizumab?
So, Kristen, first question here. This patient on imaging seemed to be progressing on the first restaging, but the patient was stable, felt good, was tolerating therapy well, and Dr. Chen continued the therapy, and she ended up having a partial response. Any thoughts about, quote, pseudo-progression, how often you see it? What do you think is going on there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we typically do think that there can be a delay in response to immunotherapy in these patients. Though interestingly, KEYNOTE-177 showed the median time to tumor response was less than 2 months. So it may not be that common. But I do tell patients, we may not see good results at the first scan. If you're clinically stable and symptoms are not worsening, I often will continue, especially in the MSI high setting. So we do see that delayed response occasionally.
Eric, curious also your thoughts about this, but also about the pneumonitis that this patient experienced, and also what it's like trying to work up patients nowadays for pneumonitis with the issue of COVID on board as well. And the other question she has is, it doesn't look like it was that, major of an issue. Responded well to corticosteroids. The issue about restarting. Any thoughts, Eric?
Yeah, a lot of difficult questions in this. We see also sometimes some patients with slight increase. I've seen several patients also with MSI high tumors with cutaneous metastasis, where we saw the increase, more inflammation of the cutaneous, subcutaneous metastasis. Likewise, you can see that also with the liver metastasis or intraperitoneal tumor. So if patients are clinically doing fine, if we see that after first evaluation, then we usually continue in these patients, like Kristen said, also in this setting. The pneumonitis, in my experience, occurs, but it's not so frequent. We do see happening it in a patient like this. If there was a clear benefit, and of course you've always to balance benefit versus side effects. If the pneumonitis can be treated easily, then the steroids can be the dose can be decreased and stopped, then I would considering resuming pembro in a patient like that in this setting. Today, yes, in theory, the difference between COVID pneumonia and a pneumonitis is not always easy, although the characteristics, the clinical setting may be different. Patients with really this pneumonitis on COVID, in my experience, they are more sick. Of course, you do testing. You do the PCR testing. If that's not clear, we may do bronchoalveolar lavage to detect if the COVID test is negative and if you have a suspicion because of contacts or whatever in the setting. And usually you can sort that out quite easily, quite fast in the first day of that you have the patient in hospital.
And I'm talking to a general medical oncologist almost every day, and it's amazing how many cases of COVID I hear about. Not infrequent deaths in oncology patients. So obviously it's a very important issue. Audience, we've got a question for you. We're talking about MSI high. Real simple. You got a younger patient, good condition. Let's just say they have moderate symptomatology for metastatic disease. What's your usual therapy going to be in that situation? And Kirsten, I'm going to come back to you. Looks like the majority of the audience is saying Pembro, but maybe 15% of people are saying Ipi/Nivo. Any thoughts, Kristen?
I think either is reasonable. We don't have any head-to-head data on which is better, Pembro versus Nivo Ipi, in cross-trial comparisons, which are always really fraught with difficulty. The Nivo Ipi response rates were a little bit higher, but again, different sample sizes, different population. So, I do worry a little bit about the added toxicity from Ipi, and I've certainly seen that in my practice. So, I think either would be fine. I tend to do more Pembro myself in this setting if I'm going to do immunotherapy.
And actually, we have an interesting case in terms of complications with Ipi/Nivo. Eric, same thing, single agent?
Yeah, I agree. The majority of patients, I would go for Pembro single agent today with the data that we do have and with my experience also.
So Eric, you mentioned the KEYNOTE-177 update. Of course, we saw this data at the virtual ASCO meeting. What did you learn from the update this year, Eric?
Well, we have seen updates on quality of life and also here the updates on PFS, as you're showing the PFS2, which shows we will need, which confirms, let's say, the activity of the strategy of starting with the checkpoint inhibitor in the majority of patients. We would love to see the survival, of course, but seeing that the PFS2 is also longer with Pembro compared to chemo gives hope that this will impact also on survival. But of course, we need to see the data.
So Kristen, I feel like I'm talking about MSI disease every day now when we do our GYN programs, because of course, in endometrial cancer, this is a real issue. And they're looking over at you because they don't have this randomized first line data and wondering, maybe we ought to be jumping on board without a randomized trial. Other situations with MSI, do you think we're moving towards sort of managing these patients more based on the marker than the tumor of origin, Kristen?
I think it's becoming a little bit more like that, though. I think that there are some, certainly with MSI being a tumor agnostic marker, not all tumor types are the same in all molecular subtypes. So for instance, BRAF and melanoma and colorectal cancer are vastly different diseases, and they respond differently to BRAF inhibition. So, I think it's hard to generalize completely, but I do think that there is some overlap between tumor types, so we can start learning from each other in different tumor types as well.
Great point. We also saw at the ASCO GI meeting a subgroup analysis. So you're talking about Ipi/Nivo in patients with MSI high. Eric, any comments on this data?
These are interesting data. I'm involved in the data, but these are interesting data telling us it's a non-randomized study that the objective response rate in the study first line around 45 patients was extremely high, above 65%. So 2/3 of patients had an objective response, which is interesting. But of course, we need to see a bit more data. Toxicity, the safety pattern also of this regimen of Ipi/Nivo was quite good. But we would love to see, and that study is ongoing right now, with Nivo versus Ipi/Nivo in the first line setting. And there was a third arm that was just a chemotherapy, a standard chemotherapy. So that's the 8HW study. That's ongoing right now, and that's going to be interesting. And that may answer some questions on the strategy in this situation.
So back to the real world, you have all your papers about real world. We do real world CME, Here's another case. This is Dr. Favreau from North Carolina. He's got a lady in her mid-50s with metastatic disease, already received chemo, biologics, BRAF inhibitor therapy, and recently initiated on TAS-102 and Bev. Here's Dr. Favreau.
She's been at home now for about 2 months. She actually feels good. She said, do I have any other options? I said, well, we have TAS-102. And I actually pulled up the recent study looking at TAS-102, given Monday through Friday, 1 week on, 1 week off, combined with bevacizumab. And that's what I'm putting her on. And she's tolerating it great.
Any evidence of response at this point?
It's too early to tell. I can tell is that she's tolerating it. And that, I think she's, you know, she's somebody who's got a lot of side effects from a lot of different chemos in the past. I wanted her to have something that she'd have good quality of life with. And so I'm starting her at a very low dose of TAS-102. And so I would have interesting questions for the faculty about, are you incorporating this lower dose TAS-102 with bevacizumab in patients that are heavily pretreated, but they want something else? Is that a good option for patients?
So Eric, of course, you've done the research on this strategy, but I'm also interested in, you know, this patient, like many with metastatic disease, had gotten to a point where she was pretty debilitated, multiple therapies, you know, a lot of questions about, you know, palliative care versus active care. Here was a situation, this patient was considering hospice and hopefully she'll benefit from therapy. Any comments about this regimen, but also this space, Eric, in terms of clinical decision-making?
Yeah, that's of course a decision, a shared decision that the physician, the oncologist and the patient and often the family also has to take a discussion. How far does a patient want to go? Does he or she still want chemotherapy or not in this setting? So a careful discussion, and that's a part of our job in GI cancer, but also for many other oncologists in this situation, to discuss benefit, risk, let's say it like that, and to discuss end-of-life topics with some of the patients who said, I've got it, I don't want anything anymore. But in patients, if you want to treat them, then I do think the combination of TAS plus BEV, although we have only phase two data, combination of TAS plus BEV may offer an extra advantage over TAS alone. We've seen a randomized phase two study of TAS BEV plus versus TAS showing a benefit for the combination. There is a phase three study in the third line in pre-treated patients that is ongoing. But I do believe, and I do it in some patients who are fit, that this may be, for at least some patients, an option. When I do start TAS-BEV, I usually start the full dose, the recommended dose, so I don't lower the dose of TAS because there's no overlapping toxicity of TAS and bevacizumab. TAS is mainly neutropenia, sometimes a bit fatigue, sometimes a bit GI toxicity. So I give the full dose. If I consider that a patient would not be fit enough, let's say, to give a full dose of TAS-102, then I would rather say, well, maybe it's not worth to start and then rather go for symptomatic care in these patients.
Of course, Kristen, you know, another option in this space that people talk a lot about and utilize a lot is regorafenib. Again, I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts about treating patients in this setting. Eric brought up the really important point of really involving the patient and family. Have you seen patients benefit and feel, you know, a sense of gratification that they went forward with therapies like this? And any comments in general about managing this situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I do think it's really important to have good communication between the physician and patient, understanding that response rates in those later line therapies are not as good. You know, so really understanding what the expectation is for the patient, I think, is very important. But, you know, the TAS regimen and TAS BEV, really very tolerable. We've been doing a lot more of TAS every other week with BEV, especially during the pandemic to avoid some of the neutropenia. And we've been able to maintain full doses there. I think with, you know, as it pertains to regorafenib, which is often used in that space too, I think doing the redose dosing, which we studied and really found to be much more tolerable, and you can escalate it if tolerated. So starting at 80 milligrams per day and escalating to toleration, you know, really, really can be beneficial. And also using prophylactic clobetasol to prevent the hand-foot syndrome.
But so Erica, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say regorafenib is typically harder and has a harder toxicity profile. So it really kind of depends on the patient.
And just to follow that up, though, how do you usually sequence these? A lot of patients end up getting both, Kristen. How do you decide which one's going to be first? And how does it vary based on, you know, the kind of condition the patient's in?
Yeah, not an easy question, how to sequence them. I have patients that I start first Rego and then TAS, and then other patients that I start TAS and then Rego. If they are fit, if I think that they can go for the different lines, for both lines, still in case of eventual progression, then I may, and if they are fit, then I may start with Rego. I start with the lower doses according to the recent studies, and then later on TAS. If I think the patient is borderline fit and that if he falls off because of toxicity, that he will not continue anything, then I may start a TAS in this situation. Efficacy, no comparative phase 3 studies, as you know. But with Rego, I've seen a bit longer responses than with TAS. This now may change also if you use TAS-PEF in the setting. So the jury is still out, and there is not one standard sequence. There are the two options are probably correct options.
And you could hear Dr. Favreau, you know, really, this patient had a lot of issues before, a lot of toxicity. He really wanted to find something that was not going to cause a problem, just almost, if anything, to kind of gain her trust. And I think that may be why he started with TAS. Interesting question in the chat room, Kristen. Adjuvant or neoadjuvant treatment of MSI-high colon cancer, chemo versus immunotherapy? You know, I have this thing in my head that MSI-high, quote, doesn't respond to chemo in the adjuvant setting. And yet in the metastatic setting, we already talked about that. But I don't know if there are situations where you would consider it. Any thoughts, Kristen?
So in the adjuvant setting, there are ongoing trials, and I would definitely wait for that data. I would not do, outside of a trial. And I think that information is really key for us to know. But in the neoadjuvant setting, I actually have an ECOG study that's about to open this spring in the MSI-high rectal, locally advanced rectal cancer, doing neoadjuvant nevo-ipi plus short course radiation followed by TME. We're really excited about that because it does take, you know, we're doing a lot more TNT, and so it does take out that potential for FOLFOX if patients will have a nice response. So, you know, but again, that's definitely experimental at this point. So, but we're looking forward to getting that data. And then, you know, definitely in the neoadjuvant metastatic setting, I mean, it's first line metastatic, but if you're hoping to get to a resection, I have certainly used that with success. So that's a little bit of a different space, but definitely something I would consider to use.
Wow. Neoadjuvant ipi-nevo and rectal cancer. That is fascinating. So yeah, let's go to another case here. Eric, this is a 70-year-old patient who's got metastatic disease. She's MSI high and BRAF mutated, PD-L1 positive, and a somatic BRCA mutation. So here's Dr. Brenner's question about this case.
In a few weeks of treatment, she developed a very unusual presentation of profound weakness, joint pain, muscle pain, felt very weak, and was ultimately diagnosed with panhyperpituitarism. My question for the clinical investigators, in patients who have a BRAF mutation and a microsatellite high tumor, how do you sequence between immunotherapy and a BRAF inhibitor? Should we start with immunotherapy first and use a BRAF inhibitor when they or if they progress? What is the role of dual checkpoint inhibitor therapy versus single checkpoint inhibitor therapy? When do we stop immunotherapy in patients who are in complete remission after receiving immunotherapy? So Neil, I got three patients with colon cancer, MSI high, complete remission on checkpoint inhibitor therapy. One guy's out about 4 years, refuses to let me stop. Younger woman of 50 with peritoneal disease. She's only about 6 months into immunotherapy, complete remission. And then this lady who's out, you know, over a year. And she almost died. I checked a random cortisol and it was undetectable. And that's how we made the diagnosis of the panhyperpituitarism. She could have died. The symptoms were going on for a month or two. I think some people do random cortisol levels as a regular screening together with thyroid monitoring. And I have started doing that after this case, especially in patients who get the, you know, CTLA-4 blocker and the PD-L1 inhibitor.
So, Kristen, I saw you shaking your head a few times as he was talking. I should have mentioned before he got actually ipi-nivo, then over to single-agent nivolumab, and you heard what happened was that she was diagnosed with panhypopit. Interestingly, her thyroid wasn't off in the beginning, mm-hmm. and then the thyroid crashed. So, mm-hmm. first of all, Kristen, any thoughts about complications with immunotherapy, particularly when you add a CTLA-4? Have you seen panhypopit? Any thoughts about this case?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that. And I think some of the toxicities from immunotherapy can be a little bit insidious. And so sometimes patients can even present to other physicians. I had a case of this recently with a patient with terrible adrenal insufficiency from her Nevo Ipi. And she had been to the hospital several times, closer to her home. And it was hard to diagnose, and some of the physicians, non-oncologists there, were not familiar with the potential toxicities. So I think it is a challenge. I saw a question in the chat whether you could re-challenge, once you have hormone replacement. And I do think that is possible. I've done that in the past, as opposed to, say, like a grade 3 or 4 pneumonitis, in which I probably would not re-challenge. And then in terms of, the very interesting question about how long do you continue? So especially in the metastatic setting, the initial Pembro studies stopped at, 2 years essentially. And I've had several patients from that study, metastatic pancreas, metastatic colon, who stopped after about a year, year and a half of therapy due to toxicity, but nothing terrible. They could have restarted if they wanted to, who are still in, NED 5-6 years later. So it has been incredible to see that possibility, which we usually don't see with traditional chemotherapy. But it really is difficult. I'm hopeful that maybe with ctDNA and MRD testing, that maybe we can ultimately find, be able to tell when is a safe stopping point. But that study I mentioned, the Nevo Ipi in rectal cancer, that's one of the things that we're going to incorporate. And I think a lot of trials now with immunotherapy are doing that, because you can't always depend on the imaging either, because sometimes the imaging looks like there's still disease and you take it out and it's just fibrosis. So it really is a challenge.
So Eric, I don't know how often you see BRAF mutations in an MSI high patient. If you do, how do you decide when you're going to use BRAF therapy as opposed to checkpoint therapy?
Yeah, there is clearly overlap. Some BRAF V600E mutants are MSI high and vice versa. If patient has both, like this patient, I would start definitely with the checkpoint inhibitor only after progression eventually treat the patient with a BRAF inhibitor plus a cetuximab in our practice. The responses with checkpoint inhibition, the response rate, cross-trial comparisons again, is a bit higher. But especially the main argument for me is that the response duration with the checkpoint inhibitor is clearly longer than with a BRAF inhibitor. And on top of that, I think the safety profile is a bit better, although we have been discussing some examples of toxicity, but a well-trained oncologist should recognize this problems like the patient here. And once you recognize them, you can treat them. In the beginning, it's sometimes indeed a bit difficult, but that are main arguments for me to start first with the checkpoint inhibitor and then later with the BRAF targeted therapy.
So, Kristen, between ovarian cancer, breast cancer, pancreatic, and prostate, I feel like I'm talking about PARP inhibitors all day long. Mm. But this patient has a somatic BRCA mutation. I'm curious if you would consider, if you ran out of options, which seems like it might take a while with these two markers, yeah. Have you ever used a PARP inhibitor? Would you feel differently if it was a germline mutation?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in colon cancer, we're a little bit further behind in terms of whether PARP inhibitors are helpful in patients with DNA damage deficiency. So, but that being said, I would definitely consider, you know, obviously I would consider a clinical trial in that regard. And I have had, you know, certainly it also portends response to platinum agent. So if the patient hadn't had oxaliplatin, that would be a clear, you know, a clear indicator. But it is a very active area of research, and I think we'll have more data in the near future about that.
So audience, I'm curious what your second line therapy is in a patient with a V600E mutation. We're going to say they got FOLFIRINOX BEV first line. Curious what you would do next. Eric, quick catch question from the chat room from Jeffrey. Do patients with metastatic stage 4 colon cancer with KRAS Q61K on NGS respond, or should they avoid EGFR antibodies?
No, they don't respond. These patients with this KRAS Q61K, I can't remember. I've seen them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't respond, I think.
Interesting. Okay. And in terms of the audience, it looks like, Kristen, the vast majority of the audience is saying encorafenib, EGFR antibody. I know where you live, it's panitumumab in your area. Yes. Any comments on that? Of course, we had the Beacon trial and the approval with this strategy. Any comments?
Yeah, I think what the Beacon study showed us was that the triplet was certainly more toxic, the addition of binimetinib to encorafenib and anti-EGFR. So the triplet was more toxic and really did not add much in terms of response or PFS. So, you know, that was a welcome finding, actually. So I think all of us and certainly the FDA here in the U.S. has approved the doublet. So I definitely would do that as well. I've had cases in which I started with the triplet prior to the final results of Beacon. And so it's been nice to be able to actually drop the MEK inhibitor, and because there's a definite clear difference in toxicity, in particular GI toxicities and anemia, with the addition of binimetinib.
So we want to talk about some more papers that were presented. And Eric, you actually had a very interesting study that you presented, the phase 2 study of TAS-102 plus BEV plus K plus in the first line setting. Any comments on this trial?
It's a phase 2 study, so but it's interesting. This is for specific patient population, patients not fit enough, not good candidates to have a doublet cytotoxic, so no good patients for FOLFOX or FOLFIRI or KPOX. So we treated them with TAS plus BEV versus KBEV. This is in maybe 5 to 10, 15% of the patients the case of. What we have seen here is that the combination of TAS plus BEF was well tolerated and was numerically slightly better compared to KBEF. It's randomized phase 2 study, but 150 patients were included. The phase 3 study has started right now to confirm that. But it's an interesting combination for sure. This was a study in the first line treatment of colorectal cancer, different than what we discussed earlier on later lines.
Right. And another thing I want to ask Kristen about, I feel like I'm hearing more and more, you know, of course, in our hematologic series, CLL, AML, everybody uses MRD, myeloma, they use MRD. Now I'm starting to hear more of circulating tumor DNA and solid tumors. And we saw some data on that in the GI Cancer Symposium. Any comments?
Yeah, so I think we're all anxious to see more data, and there are many trials ongoing right now that will help us, you know, answer that question. So, you know, one interesting study or set of results that was presented by Van Morris from MD Anderson looked at BRAF mutation allele frequencies and in you know, liquid biopsies. And found, you know, and we definitely see this, that there are patients who clearly have a clonal BRAF mutation, and those that have subclonal, you know, mutations that emerge over time in response to therapy, perhaps anti-EGFR therapy and whatnot. And it was clearly better in the patients who had a clonal mutation, treatment was better. So that was important to know. So I think that's one indicator in which it's going to be really important utilizing ctDNA. And then for the MRD component as well, that's still a wide open field. This next study looked at ctDNA for relapse detection in patients with colorectal cancer. And it just gives us more information that this is a prognostic marker, better than CEA, but we are still looking to see, okay, if we see positive ctDNA post-op, and we do something about it, is that actually going to change patient outcomes? And I think that's the big unanswered question right now.
So, Eric, I'm curious about your thoughts of this strategy, both clinically, but me more importantly, in terms of research and trial design.
Yeah, for trial design, it's crucial right now. I think most trials should include that. We are on the edge of changing in clinical practice in a few years from now, I think, but therefore we need a bit more confirmation in clinical trials, and especially also the dynamics of tumors under pressure. A tumor may change its characteristics, and therefore these liquid biopsies are crucial also to fine-tune during the further course the treatment options. Right now in clinical practice, in our setting, we don't use it in clinical practice yet today in 2021 for treatment decisions, but that's going to change in the near future.
So let's take some more quick questions from the chat room. Kristen, any pearls about using bevacizumab in patients with an intact colon primary?
Yeah, I generally will hold bevacizumab with the first cycle when I'm starting therapy. Many patients are bleeding already, and I don't, you know, I may not have a great sense of how quickly their tumor is growing. So, you know, generally patients will start to respond quickly. And so, you know, adding bev in with the second cycle is usually very safe. You know, obviously, if patients are near obstructed or have any indicator of that on CT scan prior to therapy, then I hold off on Bev until they've had a clear response.
So, Kristen, just another quick question from the chat room. I guess when we were talking about circulating tumor DNA, got thinking about CEA, and particularly patients who don't have the CEA elevation with tumor progression. Kristen, any other promising markers or any markers that you can use in practice?
Mm-hmm. I think right now, nothing is ready for prime time. You know, that's why we really need these data from the ongoing studies to see about ctDNA. You know, I do use ctDNA for looking whether I'm going to rechallenge a patient with anti-EGFR therapy. If they've developed resistance and a mutant RAS subclone, then I can, you know, after giving them a break from anti-EGFR therapy, after a few months, I'll recheck their liquid biopsy and see if that clone has disappeared, in which case I might rechallenge. So that is a case that I'm using right now. But for the most part, for the true MRD testing, you know, it is, I don't think it's ready for prime time yet, but I think it will get there for sure in the near future.
So Eric, a great question from the chat room. A patient with colorectal cancer has an indication to use a checkpoint inhibitor, but with underlying inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease in remission, would you offer a check? You know, MSI high patient, for example, Eric, would you offer a checkpoint inhibitor? Which concomitant autoimmune diseases do you feel is a contraindication? So I've heard people talk about multiple sclerosis, and I'll throw in there patients with prior transplant, for example, renal transplant. How do you think that went through? Let's say, for example, Eric, a patient MSI high metastatic disease.
Yeah, patients with transplant, I will not treat them with checkpoint inhibitors if they are under immunosuppression. Patients with inflammatory bowel disease under anti-TNF or more serious treatments, when the inflammatory bowel disease is active, I will not treat them with a checkpoint inhibitor. However, if they had Crohn's disease without any signs of activity, or ulcerative colitis without any signs of activity, without any specific anti-inflammatory treatment, that would not be a reason for me not to treat the patient. But the patient has to be monitored clearly very closely, and that's also a patient I would treat only with Pembro. I would not give this type of patients a combination with of Nivo plus EP, for instance, in this group of patients. And then for the other autoimmune diseases, I would be very careful, very reluctant. I had recently a patient with an MSI high G junction cancer that we planned to start with a checkpoint inhibitor, but then he had a history of autoimmune pancreatitis. And then just at the moment that we planned to start him with a checkpoint inhibitor for his G-junction tumor, his liver function went up. We did a liver biopsy. His IgG4 was positive, and it was an autoimmune hepatitis. So these patients, so you have to be very careful in this setting and always look carefully at it. If there is activity or a treatment of autoimmune disease, then I would be a bit reluctant in my practice to treat them with checkpoint inhibitors. And wow. So we didn't start with the checkpoint inhibitor in this patient because we put him on high doses of corticosteroids in combination with azathioprine for his autoimmune hepatitis. So he never started with the checkpoint inhibitor.
Any comments, Kirsten? You know, two of the conditions I hear a lot of controversy about is like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis, mm-hmm. kind of like in between. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've had patients with any of these autoimmune problems get checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, I agree with Eric completely. It depends on the severity and how recent the treatment has been, you know, and what kind of treatment, what systemic therapy versus topical therapy has been needed. So there's nothing more disappointing than finding an MSI high metastatic colorectal patient who has a disqualifying autoimmune, you know, condition. I had one recently with very mild myasthenia, but, you know, I just can't take the chance. So on the other hand, I had a recent patient who had a history of inflammatory bowel disease who, you know, we investigated and kind of looked into the history more. He has HCC, so I was trying to give him a Tezobev. And, you know, we felt that the history of that was remote enough and he wasn't requiring any systemic therapy. So we went ahead and treated him. He's done beautifully. So it really, you know, it really takes some personalization and case by case basis for sure.
So difficult when your patients run out of options. Mm-hmm. They have very limited life expectancy. But on the other hand, so, you know, a terrible situation when you induce a serious problem. Mm-hmm. Eric, I want you to respond to this next case. The patient's a 65-year-old man, Dr. Deutsch in North Carolina, is managing this patient. Has previously been treated for metastatic disease, but now really has just got a high CEA or an increasing CEA. Here's Dr. Deutsch's question.
This is a 65-year-old gentleman initially diagnosed with rectosigmoid colon cancer in November of 16. He also had a concurrent renal cell carcinoma in his left kidney, former IV drug abuser, Hep C positive. So this is one of these tough scenarios where this is not the easiest guy to give chemotherapy to, albeit he's never had a febrile neutropenic episode, but he's got other factors with his hepatitis. And, you know, clearly has a rising CEA, clearly there's disease somewhere, but nothing I can see, nothing I can follow, and he's completely asymptomatic. So, you know, you always get into the situation with people with metastatic disease where they're asymptomatic and you know your treatment is going to make them feel worse than their disease is making them feel. So where's the point at which you think, you know, when do I treat them? Quality of life issues. I have not treated him because he's just really been completely asymptomatic.
So, Eric, the art of oncology. Any thoughts about this case, this situation, and the use of treatment holidays?
Yeah, treatment holidays are important for patients, especially in Europe, where we, and especially in France, where I'm in Belgium, but in France, where patients usually want to take 2 months of summer holidays to go to Woodstock or some of your festivals.
Come over.
But being serious, yeah, treatment holidays are important for these patients. And patients with such a low tumor burden, with a disease course of 4 or 5 years, 2016 to 2021, it's probably not a very aggressive disease. And if that patient has only one localization, we would for sure discuss this patient at the MDT, look at the scans to see whether surgery is an option. If it's the only localization, we would do a PET CT and eventually an MRI also to locate it very well and to see whether it's possible with resection or radiotherapy in a patient like that. I would be reluctant to start too fast in a patient like that with a history of FOLFIRI and neutropenia with only one localization to start with chemotherapy. I would rather withhold him from chemotherapy until he has really evolution of the disease if operation or a local radiotherapy is not possible.
So here's our final case, and Kristen, you can respond to that. A 34-year-old woman with metastatic disease, which really introduces the topic of young people with colorectal cancer. You can see she's MSS stable, no cargo mutations, TMB low. They did a sort of a desperation attempt at surgery with her. They thought maybe they're going to be able to like do some kind of debulking. She's already had multiple treatments. So I think just because she was young, they went to surgery. They were not able to really do any kind of resection. And she was just recovering from that surgery when I spoke with Dr. Chachki. Here's what she had to say.
She is 34-year-old female. In 4 months, had required multiple paracentesis, recurrent hospitalizations. So she has two sons. One is 2 years old and one is like 13 years old. She's a single mother. Only social support is her mother. She did have difficulty tolerating chemotherapy. She's still slowly recovering. She has not been able to resume the systemic treatment yet. She still has a non-healing wound in the abdomen, which from where she's slowly recovering. So obviously having two sons, single mother with the extensive colon cancer in only 34-year-old female, I would like to do anything and everything is possible to save her or extend her life as much as possible. What else can we do for this patient? Why do we see more and more patients with colon cancer, stage 4, advanced cancer at the young age? Is it something environmental? Is it something genetic? Is it something food or any habit related? It's a challenge to take care of 34 years old with this 2 years old being at home with the mother and calls on a FaceTime, "Mom, when are you coming home?" That's a challenge.
So, Kristen, I see you shaking your head. You know, it used to be that breast cancer is where we thought about young patients with, yes, you know, minor children. And now I think you're hearing more and more cases like this. Any comment, Kristen, first of all, about why it is that we're seeing these patients younger now and with more advanced disease? I would imagine they're getting delayed. And there was actually a paper at the ASCO GI meeting we were going to talk about the fact that in general, I think these people end up seeing two or more doctors 75% of the time because nobody thinks about it. Any thoughts about the medical management, but also the psychosocial issues that come up in this situation, Kristen?
That is so challenging. That's probably the biggest challenge in my practice right now. Probably the vast majority of my colorectal cancer patients, especially rectal patients, locally advanced rectal, but also just metastatic colon, are less than 50, and the youngest is 22. So it is a clear difference in pattern, and it's projected to get worse. So, you know, some things will be helpful, earlier screening. We're trying to educate primary care doctors that, you know, no matter how young the patient is, if they have bleeding or concerning symptoms, send them for workup, send them for colonoscopy. I don't know, you know, I think the origin of this trend is multifactorial, and there are multiple studies, you know, being done right now to try to elucidate what factors these are. It's clearly not only genetic. So that's one thing, but it does add a whole another layer to their treatment in terms of really figuring out, you know, toxicity allowances and these kinds of things and cure, you know, in the patients that have the potential for cure, you want to do everything possible. Like you do for all the patients, but it just has this added layer of emotional, you know, difficulty. So I think we're going to learn how to do that more and more by out of necessity in the next few years. But so hopefully as our research expands and we learn better treatments, hopefully we can improve, you know, patient outcomes in these young patients as well.
So many topics that we could talk a lot about, but I do want to get through a few new things. So, Eric, about napobucosin, there's actually a press release just came out February 9th saying that the CAN-STEM trial we have here actually turned out to be negative. Any thoughts about this drug and what's been going on the last few years, Eric, and this press release?
Yeah, that's indeed very recent information, not yet available at ASCO GI, the press release. This is the data from a randomized phase 3 study, second line FOLFIRI plus optional BEV plus or minus this drug, napobucosin. the mechanism of action is not completely clear. Stem cell inhibition, interference with the STAT3 pathway. That drug was full of hope. We have seen negative study in gastric cancer, pancreatic cancer, and now colorectal cancer. So I think in GI cancer, it's over and out for this drug, unfortunately, in this setting. The quality of the trial was fine. The methodology was okay. Just probably the activity of the drug that is not just good enough. And it's important to mention also that this drug, the way the design of the study was, that it's an all-comer, so no good biomarker for this drug mechanism of action has yet been found in this setting. So, we have to learn more, but it's probably too late right now for this drug to recover it in any of the GI cancer indications.
So I'm going to close out on a positive note. And Kristen, I feel like we're talking about trastuzumab deratoxin every day because it started out with breast cancer, then lung cancer, colorectal, approved in gastric cancer recently, bladder cancer. I'm hearing people talk about it. So just real briefly, what is TDXD, Kristen, and what do we know about it in terms of colorectal cancer?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting drug, as you mentioned, being studied in many different tumor types, but finally have a positive study in colorectal cancer, where it's an antibody drug conjugate. And in this study, the cohort A, which was the true HER2 positive patients who had either IHC 3 plus or IHC 2 plus and FISH positive, were given TDXD at an interesting dose, 6.4 mg per kg. There are now studies under being done that looking at different doses. But ultimately what this study showed was that these were about a third of the patients had already had anti-HER2 therapy. And so, and still there was a really good response rate of about 45.3% in this cohort. So this overall disease control rate was 83%. And that included the patients who had had prior anti-HER2 therapy. So it's really interesting. You know, I think the one caution or caveat is the fact that there was about a 6% incidence of interstitial lung disease. So that is really important for us to know and to monitor for that, because there were two grade 5 events despite steroid treatment.
So, Eric, you know, I never asked you why you called it the TOGA trial, but I love the name of the trial with trastuzumab that you did many years ago, plus chemotherapy, that became standard in gastroesophageal cancer. What do we know about HER2 and colorectal cancer? What kinds of HER2 alterations do you see? Amplification, mutations? TDXD in lung cancer is given for mutant disease, and breast, it's amplified disease. What do we see in colorectal cancer, and where do you see things heading with this agent?
Well, colorectal cancer, we see HER2 positivity is not very frequent. It's most often amplification or positivity on immunohistochemistry. And we use the criteria like we do in stomach cancer, either IHC 3 plus or IHC 2 plus followed by positive FISH test. Patients are with HER2 positive colorectal cancer are mainly located in left-sided tumors and RAS wild type tumors. And if you look at the different studies with different HER2 targeted combinations, the activity is most often confined to the RAS wild type left sided tumors. So you can use as a policy to look in all patients with colorectal cancer, but if you want to enrich the testing strategy, then you can decide to look at it in left-sided RAS wild-type tumors in this setting. HER2 also, another important piece of information is HER2 plays an important role in the resistance to EGFR antibodies. Today, in HER2 positive patients, I will still start with chemo plus an EGFR antibody in these patients before HER2 targeted treatment if the tumor is also HER2 positive. But that strategic question has to be resolved. And I do think this agent, as Kirsten said, is active. It's active across different tumor types, in colorectal cancer. The study of the Italian group was very interesting, high response rates. I do think that's an agent for the future, let's say, in this group of patients with HER2 positive patients. And today, in all my patients, I want to have, as one of the biomarkers, I want to have the knowledge of HER2 status in my patients to have the treatment options for later lines. 100% sure in all patients with left-sided RAS wild-type tumors, but I prefer to have it on file for all patients.
So, Eric and Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your experience and knowledge with us.